I'll have no divided loyalty, Brandt. You'll serve me and only me. Do you have a problem with that?
Everyone I've sworn anything to is dead, except maybe my wife. But I have some questions. If you're the new Shingar, who's the old one? Is he still alive? How many fronts is this war going to have?
Jarl was silent.
I'm the old Shingar. I'm retiring, and not because Jarl is forcing me to. I've been grooming him for this for years, but now events have forced our hand. The Warrens are our center of power, Brandt, and they're dying. Starvation is already a problem, but pestilence comes next. The God King doesn't care what happens here. He hasn't set up any power structure at all. If we want to survive, and by we, I mean the Sakage, but I also mean Cenaria and every wretched soul in the Warrens, things have to change. We can still get wagons and boats in. The soldiers check the cargoes for weapons, and they demand bribes. But we can survive that. What we can't survive is what happens once every wagon that comes in loaded with food gets plundered. People are starving, and there are no guards to stop the theft. And if one wagon is plundered, every wagon thereafter will be. If that happens, the merchants will stop sending anything in. Then everyone will die. We aren't there yet, but we're close.
So, what are you going to do?
We're going to set up a quiet government. Everyone knows me. I can hire bashers to guard wagons. I can adjudicate disputes. I can direct the building of shelters.
That makes you a target.
I'm a target no matter what. We've lost some of the wet boys, and I don't mean they're dead. The wet boys swear a magically binding oath of obedience to the Shingar. The God King has broken that bonding. I've learned that Hugh Gibbet told the God King who I was. Garroth doesn't believe a woman could be the Shingar, so now he's searching for the real one. But he might change his mind any day, whether I act publicly or whether I stay in the shadows. I can't control that, so I might as well do what needs to be done.
Tell me my part.
You take your pick of my men and make them witch hunters. After that, I want you to make defenses we can use if the army comes to the Warrens in force. The Caladorans have witches, soldiers, and some of our best people on their side. The only reason I'm still alive is that they don't know who I am. But welcome aboard.
My pleasure.
Brandt Agon bowed awkwardly because of his injuries and followed a big bodyguard out the door.
You didn't tell me you knew each other?
I don't think I do know this Brandt Agon.
Answer the question.
A slight smile touched her lips, amused and a little proud that Jarl was taking command.
30 years ago, Brandt fell in love with me. I was naive. I thought I loved him too, and I ruined him.
Did you love him?
The question was proof to Mama Kay that she'd chosen the right man to succeed her. Jarl could find cracks. But it was one thing to admire his ability and another to experience it. She smiled a smile that didn't reach her eyes. It wouldn't fool Jarl for a second, but after all these years, the mask was pure reflex.
Galen Starfire is said to have thrown the blue Kakari into the sea, creating the Traxini Maelstrom. If so, it may well be there still, but I have no idea how we would recover it. The white has been lost for 6 centuries. We once believed it to be at the Chantry, but your grandmother disproved that. The green was taken to Ladesh by Hrothin Steelbender and lost. I verified that Hrothin arrived in Ladesh some 220 years ago, but could find nothing more. The silver was lost during the Hundred Years' War and could be anywhere from Aletera to Cura, unless Garrick Shadowbane somehow destroyed it. The red was cast into the heart of Ashwin Mountain, which is now Mount Tenji in Cura, by Ferric Fireheart. The brown is rumored to be at the Maker School in Osain, but I doubt it.
Why?
I don't think they could resist using it. With the mastery of Earth, those petty makers would become 100 times more skilled in a heartbeat. Something they made would appear sooner or later, and it would be clear that someone was making at the level they did of old. That hasn't happened. Either the men of that school are less ambitious than I believe possible, or it isn't there. The other rumor was that it was bound into Carnarvon's blue giant, the castle. I take that to be nothing more than a semi-educated boast. It's not a particularly clever place to hide a Kakari.
But we have a solid lead on the Red.
When Wurdmeister Quintus passed through Cura, he said that the explosions of Mount Tenji are at least partly magical. The problem with that, and with the blue, is that, even if we could get at it, there's some doubt about whether even a Kakari would be intact after having been exposed to so much elemental power for so long.
You don't give me much, Neff.
It's not exactly collecting seashells.
A deep insight. And the black?
Not so much as a whisper. Not even in the oldest books. If what I viewed was real, and the Ladeshian isn't simply delusional, it's the best-kept secret I've ever heard of.
That is the point of a secret, isn't it? Fetch our Ladeshian songbird. Oh, and Neff, I'll be needing some dust.
Aline wanted him to sell the sword. For the past 10 nights, they'd played their parts as if they were wooden puppets, except that once in a while, even puppets got to play different roles.
You don't even look at it, Kyla. It just stays in that chest under the bed.
Kyla sat on the bed rubbing his temples. He was so tired of this, so tired of everything. Did she really expect him to answer? Of course she did. It was all words and wasted air. Why did women always believe that talking about a problem would fix it? Some issues were corpses. Hot air made them fester and rot and spread their disease to everything else. Better to bury it and move on. Like Durzo. Worm food.
It was my master's sword. He gave it to me.
Your master gave you a lot of things. Beatings, not the least among them. He was an evil man.
You don't know anything about Durzo Blint. He was a great man. He died to give me a chance.
Fine. Let's talk about what I do know. We're destitute. We lost everything, and we made Aunt Mia and Brayan lose a lot, too. We have the means to make it right, and they deserve it. It's our fault those hoodlums torched the barn.
You mean my fault?
If he dealt with Tom Gray in his way, the man would have been too frightened to come within 5 blocks of Aunt Mia's. Kyler knew the music of the streets. He spoke the language of meat, played the subtle chords of intimidation, sang fear into the hearts of men. He knew and loved that music. But the notes of the songs Durzo taught weren't syllogisms. There was no thesis, counterpointed with antithesis, harmonized into synthesis. It wasn't that kind of music. The music of logic was too patrician for the streets, too subtle. The nuance is all wrong. The wet boy's leitmotif, whenever he played, was suffering, because everyone understands pain. It was brutal, but not without nuances. Without betraying his talent, Kyler could have dealt with all 6 street toughs and Tom Gray. The young men would have left with bruises and astonishment. Tom, Kyler would have hurt. How much would have been Tom's choice? But even if she had let him, could he have shown Aline that? What if she had seen his joy? He looked at her face, and she was so beautiful. He found himself blinking back tears.
What the hell was that about? Why don't we skip all the horse shit, where I say the sword is priceless and you say that means we'd have enough to start our shop, and I say I just can't do it, but I can't explain why, so you say that I really do want to be a wet boy and you're just holding me back, and then you start crying. So why don't you just start crying? And then I'll hold you, and then we'll kiss for an hour, and then you'll stop me from going further, and then you'll fall asleep easily while I lie awake with my balls aching. Can we hop right to the kissing part? Because the only part of our whole fucking lives that I enjoy is when I think you're enjoying yourself as much as I am. And I think tonight, maybe we'll finally fuck. What do you say?
Aline just took it. He could see her eyes welling, but she didn't cry.
I say I love you, Kyla. I believe in you. I'm with you no matter what. I love you. Do you hear me? I love you. I can't understand why you won't sell the sword. But I can accept it. All right? I won't bring it up again.
So now he was really the bastard. He was sitting on a fortune instead of using it to support his wife and his daughter and pay back people who'd suffered for him. But she was going to accept him.
She doesn't know me. She thinks she knows me, but she doesn't. She accepted me thinking Kyla was just an older, slightly dirtied version of Azoth. I'm not dirty. I am filth. I kill people because I like it.
Come to bed, honey.
Aline was undressing, and the swell of her breasts through her shift and the curves of her hips and her long legs roused the same fire in him it always did. Her skin glowed in the candlelight, and his eyes fixed on the point of one nipple as she blew out the candle. He was already in his undergarments, and he wanted her. He wanted her so fiercely it shook him. He lay down, but he didn't touch her. The Kakari had cursed him with perfect vision despite any darkness. Cursed because he could still see her. He could see the pain on her face. His lust was a chain, and he felt a slave to it, and it disgusted him. So when she turned toward him and touched him, he didn't move. He rolled onto his back and stared at the ceiling.
Well, I shouldn't be here. What am I doing? Happiness isn't for murderers. I can't change. I'm worthless. I'm nothing. An herbalist without herbs. A father who's not a father. A husband who's not a husband. A killer who doesn't kill. That sword is me. That's why I can't get rid of it. It's what I am. A sheathed sword worth a fortune, sitting in the bottom of a trunk. Worse than useless. A waste.
Kyla sat up in the bed, then stood. He reached underneath the bed and pulled out the narrow chest.
Honey?
Kyla dressed in moments. Blint had made him practice even this. Strapping knives to his arms and legs, securing a set of picks to a wrist and a folding grapnel to the small of his back, adjusting the gray folds of cloth so they dampen all sound, strapping retribution to his back, and pulling on a black silk mask.
Honey, what are you doing?
He didn't go out the door and walk down the stairs. No, not tonight. Instead, he opened the window. The air smelled good, free. He held the great breath in his lungs as if he could trap that freedom within him.
Just what I always do, love. I'm fucking it up.
With a surge of his talent, he leapt out into the night. Earl Callius had been given the shit duty again. After his unit had been slaughtered during the invasion, he'd been picked for every bad assignment. Throwing bodies off that rickety, half-burnt bridge, helping the cooks move supplies into the castle, helping the Meisters build the God King's new wall around the city, double and triple guard duties, and never a choice assignment like on the Vanden Bridge where the guards took a week's pay home in bribes every shift, just for letting a few crooks across. Now this. He looked at his prisoner with disgust. The man was fat, with the soft hands of a southern noble, though he wore his red beard in the Caladoran fashion. His nose was crooked and his eyebrows looked like brushes. He stared at Ferl with obvious anxiety. Ferl wasn't supposed to talk to him. Ferl wasn't supposed to know who he was. But from the first, he'd had a bad feeling about this. Ever since a captain had told him the Verdmeisters wanted to see him, they'd requested him by name. He was to report immediately. That was something no Caladoran wanted to hear. Ferl thought it was about his little souvenir, the dragon-hilted sword he'd taken from the bridge. But that hadn't been why they'd wanted him, though he'd nearly wet himself when he saw he was speaking with the Lodrakari Verdmeister Nefdada himself. No Verdmeister was normal, but Nef was spooky even for a Rordmeister. Ferl had stared at the 12 knotted cords representing the Shuras Nef had mastered for the entire time Nef spoke. It was too scary to look at his face. Nef had given Ferl and Ferl alone this assignment. He was forbidden to speak about it with other soldiers, forbidden to even associate with them for the duration of the assignment. He and the noble were confined to some tradesman's house on the east side. Meisters had hastily made part of the house a prison, Meisters had done the work. There was only one reason for that. This was so important, it had to be done instantly and without anyone's knowledge. Then, they'd left him with enough food for several months and forbidden him to leave. That left everything feeling wrong. Ferulcalius hadn't become second, now first, in his warband by being stupid. He'd spoken with the noble and learned his name was Baron Kirov. The Baron claimed not to know why he had been imprisoned. He protested his innocence and loyalty to Kalidor, and the fact he was wasting his breath telling a mere soldier told Ferul that Baron Kirov wasn't very bright. Disobeying his orders, Ferul snuck away and found out that Baron Kirov had supposedly been murdered. The good Kalidoran duke, Tensor Vargon, was now rotting in the maw for having killed a Cenarian noble who wasn't dead. That's when Ferul knew he was screwed. His imagination couldn't paint any picture in which things turned out well for Ferulcalius. Why would you assign a man without a unit to this? Because you could kill him, and no one would notice. When the time came, Baron Kirov would be released or killed. The only reason to keep him alive when he was supposed to be dead had to be so they could produce him at some point. But Ferul? Ferul would just be evidence that the Verdmeisters were lying.
I should have gone back to Kalidor.
Ferul had been offered a job tending the oxen of the baggage train. He'd almost taken it. If he had, he might have been on his way back to his clan by now. But everyone who escorted the treasure to Kalidor was thoroughly searched before they were released, and that would mean losing his precious sword. So he'd stayed, sure he could pick up a small fortune while they sacked the city. Right.
I should kill you. I should kill you just to spite them.
The fat man turned a paler shade. He could tell that Ferul meant it.
Tell me, fatty. If the Verdmeister told you that you can live if you lied about who kidnapped you, would you do it?
What kind of stupid question is that?
You're a brave man, aren't you, Farty?
What? I can't understand your accent. Why do you keep calling me Farty?
Farty! Farty!
I'm not 40, I'm 36.
Ferul's hand darted through the bars and he grabbed a handful of the Baron's blubber and squeezed it as hard as he could.
Farty! Farty!
Ferul grabbed the Baron's cheek and squeezed it with his other hand. The man flailed, trying to knock Ferul's hands away, but he was too weak.
Farty!
Ferul released him. The Baron dropped back in his cell onto his bed and rubbed his cheek and his love handle, his eyes misty with tears.
Fatty?
Ferul was lucky he didn't have a spear on hand.
Get your fat ass moving! We're leaving!
Just moving, leaping from roof to roof, flying over the world below, filled Kyler's heart with joy. Cenaria's buildings had been a mix of Curran-style rice fiber and bamboo houses, with steep clay shingled roofs and red brick and wood homes with thatch. It was rarely possible to move from roof to roof. Here, hundreds of miles from the nearest rice paddy and without the threat of snow, all the roofs were flat and solid clay, supported with good wood. For a man of Kyler's talents, they made a highway in the air. He paused at the edge of a building, rolling his neck and limbering up his back as he scooted back. The gap to the warehouse roof was a good 20 feet wide. Kyler cleared the warehouse roof easily, landing 6 feet in. He hurtled straight at a wall where the part of the roof rose to a smaller third story. It was too high for him to jump and grab the edge. Instead, he ran up the wall as far as he could and then vaulted off it. He reached for the roof beams that extended out of the building, but he missed. His fingers were half a foot below the bottom of the beam. Phantom hands whooshed out from his hands, extending his reach and pulled the beam into his grasp. Kyler flipped up and landed on the top of the 3-inch-wide beam. He wobbled for a moment, then steadied himself and stepped onto the roof. It had only taken him 3 tries. Not bad. Not bad at all. Next time, he'd try it while invisible. He was beginning to understand what his master had told him once about how much he would have to learn once he could use his talent. Just shifting from using his talent to leap to using it to extend the phantom hands was almost more than he could manage. Doing that while invisible and running full speed, well, he had nothing but time to train, did he?
For what? Time to train for what?
The thought soured the night air blowing off in the rivers. The freedom he'd felt blew away like a fog. He was training for nothing. He was training because he couldn't stand to lie next to Aline with his thoughts and emotions and lust warring in him. He alternated between wanting to tear her clothes off and take her roughly and wanting to shake her and scream at her. He feared the intensity of those emotions, feared how they overlapped. That wasn't making love. That he even thought of it made him sick. He leapt across another huge gap. As he slid past a small gang waiting to ambush whatever drunk might stumble down their alley, Kyla was fully alive. He didn't even need his powers. He was just there, every sense attuned, every fiber of his being poised to act. If one of the hoodlums discovered him, he'd have to use his powers. Flee, attack, jump, duck, hide, something. As he slid past a hood holding a knife in one hand and a wineskin in the other, he could smell the man.
Hey! Shut up! We'll never get anywhere if you idiots keep talking!
The hood's eyes passed straight over Kyler. Kyler had to keep himself from gasping aloud. There was something in the man's eyes. Something dark. It itched at something in the back of Kyler's mind. Down the alley, a man stumbled out of an inn. He braced himself against a wall and then turned to walk toward the ambush.
What am I doing? I'm mad. I'll have to get out of here.
He had to go. Now. If they started beating the drunk, he didn't know what he'd do. Or maybe he knew exactly what he'd do, and he couldn't do that. The Kakari oozed out of his pores like a sheen of iridescent black oil. It covered his skin and his clothes in an instant, covered him, shimmered for the briefest instant, and disappeared. One of the hoodlums on the other side of the alley frowned and opened his mouth, but changed his mind and shook his head. Sure that he'd imagined whatever it was he thought he saw. Kyla leapt 5 feet in the air and grabbed the edge of the roof. He pulled himself up and started running away. Kyla didn't stop. He didn't look. He was only 4 blocks away, still fleeing, heading toward Aunt Mia's house, when he saw a girl being followed by 3 more hoodlums. What the hell was she doing out this late? Anyone in this part of town had to know how stupid it was for a girl, a pretty golden-haired girl, of course, to travel alone. That was none of his business. Golden Hair looked over her shoulder and Kyla could see her tear-streaked face. Wonderful. Some stupid emotional girl being emotional and stupid. He stopped.
Damn it. You can't save the world, Kyla. You're not really the Night Angel. You're only a shadow, and shadows can't touch anything. God damn it!
In the street below, all 4 characters in the little melodrama looked up to the rooftop. But of course they didn't see him. They didn't see him drop into the street and start following them. If they caught her, he'd have to kill them. He'd have to hurt them to get them off her. And then, what was he going to do? Beat them up as an invisible man? Let them spread those stories. Someone would connect him to the Night Angel sooner or later, and then everything would go to hell. Now, if they caught her, and he had to break his promise to Aline, then he'd go all the way. So there was only one thing to do: make sure they didn't catch her. Golden Hair did the first sensible thing she'd done all night. She started running. The hoodlums split up and started after her. Kyla drew retribution off his back, but in its scabbard. He ran behind one of the running hoodlums, timed the man's step, and with the sheathed sword, he knocked 1 foot behind the other in the middle of the man's stride. The man's partner barely had time to look over his shoulder before he, too, encountered the ground in a far more intimate fashion than he would have liked. Both men jumped up and started running after the girl again, once more closing ground rapidly. This time, Kyla tripped one into the other one. By the time they got up, the girl was gone. Kyla lost sight of the girl and the last hoodlum. He leapt up to a roof and sprinted after the girl. As he ran, he dropped his invisibility so he could use all of his talent for speed. He caught sight of Golden Hair again. She was a block away from the only house in a dim alley that had a lantern burning in the window. Doubtless, it was her home. Then Kyla saw the last hoodlum. Coming down an intersecting alley, Golden Hair would have to pass. The man caught sight of her and sank back into the shadows. There was no time. Kyla was still more than a block behind them. He sprinted to the edge of a building and leapt unseen over Golden Hair, drawing retribution before he landed in the little alley right in front of the hoodlum. The man had drawn a knife, and in an instant, Kyla saw from the pools of darkness in his eyes a deep, unreasoning hatred spawned from some perceived slight. The man had murdered before, but he planned to murder Golden Hair tonight. Kyla didn't know how he knew, but he knew. And seeing that darkness that demanded death, it came to him that he'd seen it before. He'd seen it in Prince Ursul's eyes. Only afterward had he decided he must have been imagining things. Retribution darted out, punching through the hoodlum's solar plexus, driving air from his lungs and pinning him to the wall. Around the corner, a door was flung open, and Golden Hair was ushered inside. The hoodlum was straining to breathe, but he couldn't, because retribution had crushed his ribs and pushed them hard against his diaphragm. The man was already dead. He just hadn't figured it out yet.
Damn me! What have I done?
Dispassionately, Kyla stabbed the sword into his heart. Inside, it was all joy and reconciliation. Kyla felt a surge of pride, followed by disgust at how sweetly domestic it was. But that was a lie. He wasn't disgusted. He was moved. Moved and profoundly lonely. He was left outside in the streets with the dead alone.
Why would anyone destroy a Gakari, Neff?
The God King was pacing in one of his staterooms.
The Saffrons are frequently illogical, Your Holiness.
But surely these heroes who supposedly destroyed the Gakari, Garrick Shadowbane, Galen Starfire, Ferric Fireheart, surely they must have been witchborn. Not trained as meisters, of course, but talented. Such warriors could have bonded to the Gakari themselves. And they didn't. We're saying that at least three warriors chose to destroy artifacts that could have made them 10 times more powerful than they were already. Great men are not so selfless.
Your Holiness, you're attempting to duplicate the thought processes of a people who embrace the virtues of weakness. These are people who tout compassion over justice, mercy over strength. Theirs is a diseased philosophy, a species of madness. Of course they do the inexplicable. Look at how eagerly Terra Grayson rushes to her doom.
Terra Grayson is a fool, but not all the Southerns are. If they were, my forefathers would have overrun them centuries ago.
Oh, surely they would have, if not for the incursions from the Freeze.
Gareth dismissed that. The average Meister had always been stronger than the average mage, often had more companions in his craft, and he and his fellows weren't split into bickering schools spread halfway across Mid-Kiru. The Caladoran armies were as good as most and better than many. Despite those advantages, the God King's ambitions had been foiled time and again.
I feel opposed.
Opposed, Your Holiness?
Maybe these Southrons really believe what they claim about mercy and protecting the weak. Though our experience here tells me that they don't. But the call of the power is not easily ignored, Neff. Perhaps one saint of their fate might destroy a Gakari that he could use. But how could all 6 Gakari disappear and stay hidden for so long? You're talking generations of saints, each new guardian as virtuous as the one before. It doesn't make sense. One of them would fail.
The Gakari have surfaced from time to time.
Yes, but ever more rarely as the centuries have passed. The last time was 50 years ago. Someone has been trying to destroy or at least hide the Kakari. That's the only thing that makes sense.
So, someone out there has been squirreling away Kakari for 7 centuries?
Of course not someone, but some group. I find a small conspiracy much easier to swallow than a conspiracy of every Southron saint who's ever lived. Think about their very names. Shadowbane, Fireheart, Starfire. Those aren't surnames, they're assumed names. If I'm right, it may be that Garrick Shadowbane, Ferric Fireheart, and Galen Starfire were the champions of this group. They're avatars, as it were.
And their avatar today?
Now has a name. This morning, my Ledeshian bard sang. The man who walked these halls with the Kakari, who killed my son, was either the legendary Durzo Blint or his apprentice, Kyla Stern. Durzo Blint is dead. So if Kyla Stern is this avatar, it would explain why those heroes were willing to destroy a Kakari. Because they couldn't use another. Because they'd already bonded one. They were the bearers of the Black Kakari.
Your Holiness, is it not possible that rather than destroy those Kakari, they kept them?
It's possible. And Kyla might not be allied with them at all.
In which case, they might be trying to add the Black to their collection.
We can't know that. We can't know anything until we get Kyla Stern. My songbird will make the perfect assassin. In the meantime, Nef, contact every Meister and agent we have in the Southlands and tell them to keep an eye out. I don't care if it costs me this entire kingdom. Get me, Kyla Stern. Alive, dead, whichever. Just bring me that damned Kakari.
The first weeks in Hell's Asshole had been the darkest, before Logan had become a monster. He'd made his bargains with the devil and with his own body. He'd eaten the meat that came to him that awful day, and when Finn had killed Scab, Logan had eaten flesh again. Logan had to kill Long Tom for that meat, and that killing had made him a monster. Being a monster made him safe, but he wasn't content to be safe. He wasn't content to merely survive. Logan lived with the feral, primal side of himself, but he wouldn't let that be all he was. He shared his meat. He'd given some to Lily, not for sex, as the other Holers did, but for decency. She'd given him the advice that kept him human. He also shared with the other monsters, Tats and Yimbo and Nasher. He kept the choicest parts for himself, at least the choicest parts he could bear to eat. Arms and legs were one thing, but eating a man's heart, his brains, his eyes, cracking his bones to suck the marrow, that Logan wouldn't do. It was a thin line, and one he knew he would cross if things got much worse. But for now, he'd sunk deep enough. So he shared for squeamishness, and he shared for nobility. It was his first step to reclaiming his humanity. Finn would kill him the first chance he had. The monsters didn't care, so it was still possible to get them on his side. It wouldn't be loyalty, but anything might make all the difference. Nasher was a different story. Logan stayed close to Nasher. He figured that the simpleton was the least likely to betray him, although he'd learned early on why Nasher had been given his name. Every night, Nasher ground his teeth. It was so loud that Logan was surprised the man had molars left. The third week in, Logan woke to the sudden silence of Nasher's teeth and listened in the darkness. Nasher was listening, and his ears must have been better than Logan's, because a moment later, Logan heard footsteps. 2 Kalidoran guards appeared above their grate and looked down with distaste. The first was the one they hated. He opened the grate, as he always did, and tossed their bread down the hole, as he always did. It didn't matter that they knew he was going to do it. The monsters and the animals alike, even Logan, got up and stood around the hole, hoping to get lucky with a bad throw. It only happened once or twice, but that was enough to keep their hope alive.
Watch this.
He tore open the last loaf and pissed all over it, soaking it in urine. Then he tossed it in.
Come on.
Logan, being the tallest, got most of it. He devoured it instantly, ignoring the stench, ignoring the warm wetness dripping down his chin, ignoring the debasement. The second guard looked on uncertainly. The next day, the second guard came back, alone. He had bread, and it was clean, and he threw it to them. One loaf for each prisoner. The man didn't look any of them in the eye.
I'll bring bread with me whenever I'm not on shift with Gorky.
That gave them all strength and hope and a name for the man they hated above all others. Slowly, society returned. That first night, everyone had been so overwhelmed just to have bread that they hadn't even tried to steal loaves from each other. As they gained strength, they did fight. Within a few days, the mute Yimbo tangled with Finn and got killed. Logan watched, hoping for an opportunity to get Finn, but the fight was over too quickly. Finn's knife was too much of an advantage. When the bread came, Logan made sure he got more than most, not only for the status, but to stay strong. He'd already lost every ounce of fat he'd ever had, and now he was losing his muscle. He was all sinews and lean, hard muscles, but he was still big, and he needed his strength. Still, he shared what he could with Lily and Nasher and Tats. More than 2 months in, he made a breakthrough. He'd been feeling nervous, getting more and more on edge about Finn with his damn sinew ropes that kept getting longer. Logan slept and woke to the sound of the demons that he now sometimes imagined made the howling noise. It wasn't wind, he was sure of that. It was either demons or the spirits of all the poor bastards who'd been thrown into the hole over the centuries. His head throbbed in time with the howling. His jaw ached. He'd been grinding his teeth all night. Then he found his humanity.
Nash! Nasher, come here.
The big man looked at him blankly. Logan scooted over and very slowly put his hands on Nasher's jaw. He was afraid that Nasher might snap at him, and if Nasher bit him, down here an infection and death were more likely than not. But he reached up anyway. Nasher looked puzzled, but he let Logan slowly massage his jaw. In moments, the look on the simple man's face changed. The tension in his face that Logan had assumed was part of his deformity relaxed. Logan stopped. Nasher grabbed Logan. Logan thought he was going to die, but Nasher just hugged him. When Nasher released him, Logan knew he had a friend for life. No matter this whole life was nasty, brutish, and short, he would have wept. But he had no capacity for tears. She had to kill Jarl. Bea stood outside of Hugh Gibbet's safe house and leaned her head against the doorframe. She needed to go inside, face Hugh, get ready, and go kill Jarl. As simple as that. And her apprenticeship would be done, and she'd never have to face Hugh again. The God King had even promised she could kill Hugh if she wanted. During the year V had spent learning the trade at Mama K's, Jarl had been her only friend. He had gone out of his way to help, especially in her first weeks when she'd been such a disaster. Because of his handsome, exotic, Ladeshian features, quick tongue, intelligence, and warmth, everyone had liked Jarl, and not just the men and women who lined up for his services. Lined up only figuratively, of course. Mama Kay would never tolerate anything so crass as a queue in the Blue Boar. But V had always felt a kind of special bond between them. V stopped thinking. She had a job to do. She checked the door again for traps. There were none. You got careless when he had company. She opened the door slowly, standing to one side and holding her open hands in the gap. Sometimes, when Hugh was blasted on mushrooms, he attacked first and didn't ask questions. When no attack came, V walked in. Hugh sat bare-chested in the corner of the cluttered front room in a rocking chair, but the chair was still and his eyes were closed. He wasn't sleeping, though. V was intimately attuned to her master's every nuance. She knew how he breathed when he really slept. He held crochet hooks in his hands and a tiny, nearly completed white wool cap. A baby's bonnet this time. The sick fuck. Pretending to believe he was asleep, V glanced in the bedroom. Two women were lying in the bed. V ignored them and started gathering her gear. Finding Jarl would be no problem. She had only to put out word that she wanted to meet with him, and he'd welcome her. His guards would make sure she had no weapons, but after a time, alone with him, they'd relax, or Jarl would dismiss the guards and she could kill him with her bare hands. The problem was how not to kill Jarl. She wasn't going to do it. Fuck the God King. But the only way the God King would excuse her disobedience in this was if she could do something else that pleased him even more. V unlocked a wide cabinet and slid a drawer out. It held her collection of wigs, the best money could buy. V had become an expert at taking care of them, styling them, putting them on, and affixing them firmly enough for the rigors of her trade at a moment's notice. There was something comforting about the tug on her scalp of a firm ponytail, sometimes drawn so tight under her wig that it gave her a headache. At Mama Kay's, V had been introduced to a talented courtesan who told V she could teach her to change the color or style of her own hair with the talent. But V wasn't interested. She might share her body, or Hugh might take her body, but her hair was her own, and it was precious to her. She didn't even like men to touch the wigs, but she could tolerate it. When she whored, she wore a wig for the slight margin of disguise it gave her. Flaming redheads weren't that common outside of Kara. When she was working as a wet boy, she wore her hair in that same tight ponytail. It was sensible, controlled, and efficient, just like her. The only time her hair hung loose was in the few minutes before bedtime, and then only when she was alone and safe. After selecting a fine, straight, chin-length black wig and a long, wavy brunette, V grabbed the cream she needed to dye her eyebrows and makeup to darken her complexion, then packed her weapons. She was tying her saddlebags closed when a hand grabbed her breast and squeezed viciously. Ah. Hugh pressed his body against her back.
Hello, gorgeous. Where have you been?
Working, remember?
Hugh wrapped himself around her, and the revulsion and hatred warred for one moment with the familiar passivity before losing.
You're not wearing that perfume I like.
I've been working for the God King.
Oh, I've been having a little party, celebrating. I got a countess and a... Oh, damn, I can't remember. But the other one's a wildcat. Want to join us?
What are you celebrating?
Durzo!
Hugh released me abruptly and danced in a little circle, grabbing another mushroom off a table and popping it in his mouth.
Durzo Blint is dead.
Really? I heard that rumor. But you're sure?
Hugh had always hated Durzo Blint. The two were mentioned in the same breath as the city's best wet boys, but usually Durzo's name came first. Hugh had killed men for saying that, but he'd never gone after Durzo. If he'd thought he could kill Durzo, she knew he would have.
Mama Kay was friends with him, and she didn't believe he was dead. So she took some men to where he was buried, and sure enough, dead, dead, dead. Unlike his apprentice, the job you fucked up.
Hugh took a flask of poppy spirits and drank.
I was going to kill him, you know, just to piss off Blint's ghost. 100 crowns I wasted in bribes and turned out he left the city. Ooh, that one was potent. Help me sit down.
V's chest tightened. That was her answer. Kyler Stern was the Night Angel. He'd killed the God King's son. Killing Kyler was the only thing that might please the God King enough for him to forgive her for not killing Jarl. She grabbed Hugh's arm and guided him to his chair, making sure he avoided the razor-lined baby bonnet.
Where is he, Master? Where did he go?
You know, you don't come around enough. After all I've done for you, You bitch!
His face turned ugly and he pulled her roughly into his lap. The minutes before Hugh passed out were dangerous. He might fumble weakly as a drunk and then use the crushing strength of his talent to compensate and hurt or kill her accidentally. So she fell into his arms, quiescent, making herself numb. Hugh was distracted by her body. He tried to caress her, but fumbled his hand across the folds of her tunic instead.
Where is Blint's apprentice, master? Where did he go?
He moved to Caernarvon, gave up the Way of Shadows. Who's the best now, huh?
Oh, you're the best. You've always been the best.
Viridiana.
She froze. He never called her by her full name. She turned warily, wondering if the mushrooms had been harmless, the poppy wine just water. It wouldn't be the first time he'd pretended intoxication to test her loyalty. But Hugh's eyes were half-lidded, his figure totally relaxed in his chair.
I love you. These bitches got nothing.
These suddenly wanted to bathe. She grabbed her saddlebags and her sword, then stopped. Hugh was unconscious. She was sure of it. She could draw her blade and bury it in his heart in less than a second. He deserved it 100 times over. He deserved 100 times worse. She took the hilt in her hand and drew the blade slowly. She turned and looked at her master, thinking of 1,000 humiliations he'd inflicted on her, 1,000 defilements until he'd broken her. It was hard to breathe. Feet turned on her heel, sheathed the sword, and flung the saddlebags over her shoulder. She got as far as the door, then paused. She walked back to the bedroom. The women were awake now, one blasted with a glassy-eyed stare, the other one buck-toothed and busty.
Hugh gets bored. I give you a coin-flip chance of living through every day you spend with him. If you want to leave, he's asleep now.
You're just jealous. You want them for yourself.
Your funeral.
Is the Sakage at war or not?
Jarl shifted in his seat. Mama Kay said nothing. She was letting him lead, if he could. The safe house had taken on the appearance of a war room, that was sure. Brandt had brought maps. He was gathering data on Caladoran troop strength, noting where each unit was stationed, where food and supplies were distributed, and constructing a chart of the Caladoran military hierarchy, cross-referenced with where the Sakage had informants, along with ratings of the informants' reliability and access.
That's a more difficult question to answer than...
No, it's not.
I feel that we are in a kind of war.
You feel? Are you a leader or a poet, sissy boy?
Sissy boy? What's that mean?
Mama Kay stood up.
Sit down.
I'm waiting for an answer.
Do you have a dick or do you just suck them?
Are you hoping to get lucky?
Wrong answer. A good leader is never snide.
Jarl stood over Agon and drew a sword.
That's how I lead, Brandt. My enemies underestimate me, and I hit them when they aren't expecting it. I listen to you, but you serve me. The next time you make a dick comment, I'll have yours fed to you.
He brought the sword up between Brandt's legs.
That's not an idle threat.
Brandt found his crutch, stood with Jarl's help, and brushed off his new clothes.
Well, we've just had a teachable moment. I'm touched. I think I'll write a poem. Your answer is...
The poem comment almost set Jarl off. He was about to say something when he saw Mama Kay's mouth twitch. It was a joke. Charles shook his head. This was going to be a challenge.
We're at war.
How good is your grip on the Sakage? Because I've got serious problems here, or rather, you do.
Not great. The Caladorans have had a galvanizing influence, but revenue is way down, and command is breaking down. People not reporting to superiors, that sort of thing. A lot of people think the occupation is bound to get easier now. They want business as usual.
Sounds smart of them. What's your master plan to oppose them?
I had planned to see what they did. I wanted to learn more about them and then opposed them however I needed to.
Does it strike you as a good idea to let your enemy launch fully formed stratagems on you and then be forced to react from a position of weakness?
That's more a rhetorical bludgeon than a question, General.
Thank you.
What do you propose?
Guinevere ruled the Sakage in total secrecy with puppet Shingos, right?
Charl nodded.
So, who's been the puppet Shinga since Kalidor invaded?
I haven't exactly installed one.
Not exactly.
Brand, a little gentler.
Look at it from the street, Jarl. For more than a month, they've had no leader. Not just a bad leader, none. Guinevere's little government has been helping everyone, and so far it's going well. But your Sakage thugs... sorry, people... have been in the same boat as everyone else. So why keep paying dues? Guinevere was able to be a shadow Shinga because there was never a threat like this. This is a war. You need an army. Armies need a leader. You need to be that leader. You can't do that from the shadows.
If I announce who I am, they'll kill me.
They'll try, and they'll succeed unless you can collect a core of competent people who are absolutely loyal to you. People willing to kill and to die for you.
These aren't soldiers from good families who've been brought up on loyalty and duty and courage. We're talking about thieves and prostitutes and pickpockets. People who only think about themselves and their own survival.
And that's what they'll say, unless you see what they may be and make them see it.
When I was a general, my best soldiers came from the Warrens. They became the best because they had everything to gain.
So what exactly do you propose?
I propose you work yourself out of a job. Give your crooks a dream of a better life, a better way for their children, and a chance to see themselves as heroes, and you'll have yourself an army.
He paused to let it sink in, and soon Jarl's heart was pounding, his mind racing. It was audacious. It was big. It was a chance to use power for more than just keeping power. He could see the outlines of a plan starting to fit together. His mind was already tapping what people he would place in which positions. Fragments of speeches were glomming together. Oh, it was seductive. Brandt wasn't just telling Jarl to give the crooks a dream. Brandt was giving Jarl a dream. He could be a different type of Shinga. He could be noble, revered. If he were successful, he could probably even become legitimate, be given real titles by whichever noble family he put back in power. Gods, it was seductive. But it meant revealing himself, committing himself. Right now, he was a secret. Everyone thought he was just a retired rent boy. Less than a dozen people knew he was the Shinga. If he wanted to, he could just stop communicating with them. If he didn't try, he couldn't fail.
Jarl, just because it's a dream doesn't mean it's a lie.
Jarl looked from one to the other of them, wondering how deeply they read him. Mama Kay probably read him to the core. It was scary. He should have suspected something just by her silence, but he couldn't be angry with her. She'd had more patience with him than he deserved.
Work myself out of a job.
Aline had said she couldn't imagine Sonaria without the Sakage polluting everything. But Jarl could. It would be a city where birth on the west side didn't mean hopelessness, exploitation, time in the guilds, poverty, and death. He'd been lucky to get a job working for Mama Kay. The Warrens offered almost no honest jobs, certainly not for orphans. The Sakage was fed directly from a self-renewing underclass of whores and thieves who abandoned their children as they themselves had been abandoned before. But it could be different, couldn't it?
Fine. On one condition, Brandt. If they kill me, whichever they it happens to be, I want you to write a poem for my funeral.
Kylo sat on the bed in the darkness looking at Aline's sleeping form. She was the kind of girl who just couldn't stay up late no matter how she tried. The sight of her filled him with such tenderness and wretchedness he could hardly bear up. Since she'd promised not to ask him to sell retribution, she'd been true to her word. No surprise there. But she hadn't even hinted. He loved her. He wasn't good enough for her. He'd always believed that you became like those you spent your time with. Maybe that was part of it. He loved all the things about her that he wasn't. Openness, purity, compassion. She was smiles and sunshine, and he belonged to the night. He wanted to be a good man, ached for it. But maybe some people were just born better than others. After that first night, he'd sworn to himself that he wouldn't kill again. He would go out and train, but he wouldn't kill. So he trained for nothing and honed abilities he'd sworn not to use. Training was a pale imitation of battle, but he would be satisfied with it. His resolution held for 6 days. Then he was down at the docks and found a pirate savagely beating a cabin boy. Kyler had only intended to separate them, but the pirate's eyes demanded death. Retribution delivered it. On the 7th night, he'd been practicing simply hiding outside a midtown tavern, trying to avoid places that were likely to bring him across pimps or thieves or rapists or murderers. A man had passed by who ran a circle of child pickpockets, a tyrant who kept the children in line through sheer brutality. Retribution found the man's heart before Kyler could stop himself. On the 8th night, he'd been in the noble's district, hoping to find less violence there when he heard a nobleman beating his mistress. The night angel came in invisibly and broke the man's arms. Kyler held Retribution in his lap, looking at Aline. Every day, he promised himself he wouldn't kill. Not ever again. And he hadn't killed for 6 nights. But part of him knew that was because he'd been lucky. The worst part of it was that he didn't feel guilty for the murders. He'd felt awful every time he killed for Durzo. These skills did nothing. He felt guilty only for lying. Maybe he was becoming a Hugh Gibbet. Maybe he needed killing now. Maybe he was becoming a monster. Each day he worked with Aunt Mia. Durzo had rarely praised Kyler, so he'd never realized how much he had learned from the old wet boy. But as Kyler spent hours with Aunt Mia cataloging her herbs, repackaging some of them so they would keep longer, throwing out those that had lost their potency, labeling the rest with dates and notes on their origins, he began to see how much he did know. He was nowhere near Durzo's level of proficiency, but the man had had a few centuries on him. He had to be careful, though. Aunt Mia used many herbs medicinally that he had used for poison. She had once set aside the roots of a silver leaf, saying they were too dangerous and that she could only use the leaves. Without thinking, he'd drawn up a chart of the lethal doses of the plant's leaves, roots, and seeds by their various preparations, whether in a tincture, a powder, a paste, or a tea, cross-referenced by body weight, sex, and age of the, he almost wrote, of the deader, and only changed it to patient at the last second. When he looked up, Aunt Mia was staring at him.
I've never seen such a detailed chart. This is very impressive, Kyler.
He tried to be more careful after that, but they consistently ran into the same problems. Over his career, Durzo had experimented thousands of times with all kinds of herbs. When he'd had a debtor that he could kill without a deadline, he'd tried 5 or 6 different herbs. Kyler was beginning to appreciate that Durzo had probably known more about herbs than anyone alive, though he had usually been hired to kill healthy people, so sometimes what Kyler knew was useless. One day, a man came to Aunt Mia's shop, desperate for help. His master was dying and 4 other physicians had been unable to help him. Aunt Mia sometimes did more than midwifing, so the servant had come to her as a last resort. But Aunt Mia had been gone. Kyler had felt too awkward to go to the sick man's house, but after quizzing the servant, he'd made a potion. He heard later that the man recovered. It was strangely warming. He'd saved a life. Just like that. Still, he felt guilty living on Aunt Mia's charity. He'd spent several weeks putting her shop in order because, despite her gift for working with people, her organization skills were abominable. But he hadn't done anything valuable for her. He wasn't making her any money. Aline had gotten a job as a maid, but the pay was barely enough to cover their food. Brayan was getting more and more surly, muttering about freeloaders, and Kyler couldn't blame him. Kyler brushed his fingertips over Retribution. Every time he strapped the blade on, he acted as judge and executioner. The blade had become the emblem of his oath-breaking. Not tonight. Kyler put it back in its box and, gathering his talent, leapt out the window. He crossed the roofs to find Goldenhair's house and put everything else out of his mind. He had to worry all day long, He wasn't going to ruin his night, too. The whole family was there, asleep in their little one-room shack. Kyler turned to go, but something stopped him. The girl and her father were asleep. The mother's lips were moving. First, Kyler thought she was dreaming, but then her eyes opened and she got out of bed. She didn't light any candles. She briefly looked out the narrow window where Kyler stood invisible. She looked afraid, so much so that he double-checked his invisibility. But her eyes weren't fixed on him. He looked behind himself, but there was nobody in the street. Golden Hair's mother shivered and knelt by the bed. Praying? Son of a bitch. Kyler was at once embarrassed and angry to witness something so personal. He wasn't sure why. He cursed silently and turned to go. Three armed men were coming down the street. Kyler recognized two of them as the guys who'd chased Golden Hair the other night.
She's a witch, I'm telling you!
It's true, Shinga, I swear!
Oh, you're joking.
Caernarvon Shinga himself was checking out some thug's story about a witch? A witch? As if a witch would have tripped the men rather than killing them. Kyler looked back inside. The woman had woken her husband and both were praying now. It was odd, because from their bed, there was no way they could have seen the Sakage thugs. Maybe the woman had some talent.
Praying for protection?
Kyler sneered, and the small, mean part of him wanted to leave. Let their god solve his own problems. Kyler got as far as turning his back, but he couldn't do it.
Baruch, what do we do?
Ow! Sorry!
I meant Shinga Sniggle. What do?
We kill them.
Lovely.
They were only 20 paces away.
What if she uses witchery again, Shinga?
I ain't afraid of that shit.
As Kyler saw the man's eyes, his hand went to his back. But retribution was gone. His momentary surprise was enough to break him free of the killing impulse. He'd sworn. Damn him, he'd sworn. There had to be another way. Tonight, there would be another way. Kyler materialized in front of the Shinga, or rather, parts of him did. He let some light shine through the kakari that covered him so that he appeared with a smoky translucence. The curve of an oily, iridescent black bicep shimmered in and out of visibility. Then the curve of broad shoulders, the V of his torso, the lines of his chest muscles. All of them exaggerated so they seemed larger than they were. They faded in and out of sight like a ghost. And then Kyler topped it with his masterstroke. The kakari became solid over his eyes, making them gleam like metallic black jewels in midair. Then the rest of his face appeared, covered in a mask of black, shimmering metal molded to his skin. It was menacing. It was more than menacing. It was the very face of judgment, of retribution made flesh. And at what Kyler saw within the Shinga's eyes, hatred, envy, greed, murder, betrayal, the mask became fierce.
This family is under my protection.
He brought his left hand up and flexed it. The kakari slid out into a long, smoking punch dagger. Low blue fire sprang up in his eyes. The Shinga shook, petrified, his mouth slack.
Run!
Kyler felt no satisfaction. Just when he thought he couldn't paint himself any further into a corner, he'd done so brilliantly. What had Durzo Blint told him more than a decade ago?
A threat's a promise, boy. On the street, you can lie about everything except your threats. An empty threat is surrender.
Feeling sick, Kyler looked into the house. The woman and her husband were still kneeling by their bed, holding hands. They hadn't seen or heard anything. As Kyler looked in, though, the woman squeezed her husband's hand.
Going to be all right, I can tell. I feel better now.
I'm glad one of us does.